In case you weren't aware, today is Father's Day.
I'm pretty sure most of the fathers out here are aware of that. You've probably been reminded of that already. And it's one of the fun things is to go through and see beings that parents, whether it be a mother or father, is such an important and crucial aspect of the family relationship. And knowing that the family relationship is such a crucial and important aspect of what it means to be part of the Christian family, and how much that is, there's so much within the scriptures that help us, that guide us, that let us see how it is that we can be better. How it is that we're supposed to do this in a way that will glorify God. That we live, that we act, and that we teach, discipline, train in the proper way. And we have an abundance of stories and places where we can turn to, really, to see that. So there is really no shortage, per se, but I tell you, there is one story that it just seems really stands out. When you want to see what the love of a father really, truly looks like, and that is the story that is often referred to or known as the parable of the prodigal son. However, many of you are familiar with the fact I really don't think that's a very good name for it. And we'll talk about why that is. So this morning, what we'll actually talk about is the parable of the lost son. And see how that incorporates, or how we can incorporate the story to be better fathers, and to be the people that God wants us to be as we lead our families. Good morning. It's good to be here today, isn't it? Yeah, it's good for us to be together, to sing together, to partake of the Lord's Supper together. It's just good to be together. And really appreciate everyone who is here, who's come here, those who are a part of this family right here, who are just here to help each other, to strive with one another, people who are like-minded in ways in which we say, you know what, we need to live our lives with love and good works. We need encouragement as that day is coming, and we're going to be here for each other to do just that. I appreciate you bringing us in, enveloping us, our family, the way that you have over the last year and a half or so, and making us a part of this family. And it is something very special. We do have those, of course, who are visiting with us this morning. And I want you to know that we are very excited that you're here. We are glad that you have joined with us. It says a lot about you, that you are looking to worship God, and that you want that relationship with your Creator. And we actually feel pretty special that you chose to do that right here with us. We're glad you're here, and we hope that you will be encouraged this morning as we look at this story, which really is, I think, one of the more well-known stories within Scriptures. A lot of people are familiar with the story of the lost son. Now, as we look at the setup, it begins really back in chapter 15 in the first couple verses. Here's the setup. It says that the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to him. That is, drawing near to Jesus. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, oh, this man, he receives sinners. He eats with them. You know, it's like another story where they said, you know, if he knew who this person was, there's no way that he would let her do what it was that she was doing. And that was cleansing his feet, being in such close proximity. Remember, these are the guys that we've been railing against for quite a while through the Sermon on the Mount. They're the ones that it was necessary for Jesus to say, look, do not judge, lest you be judged, for in the manner that you judge, you will be judged. And by the measure that you judge, it will be measured against you. Yeah, these are those folks. These are the scribes and the Pharisees. They're the ones that remember David, my father-in-law, in our summer series. He talked about the prayer that Jesus gave, the parable of the prayer of the Pharisee, who said, you know what, God, I'm glad I'm not like those sinners. I'm glad I'm not like that tax collector. I'm glad that there's this great chasm between us. And I'm glad that tax collector was, at least he was smart enough to set himself off at a distance. And then the Pharisee set himself off at more of a distance, and there's a great expanse between them because he doesn't want to have anything to do with them. That's who this story is spoken to. And it's not just this story. Remember, the whole setup begins in verses 3 through 7, where you have the parable of the lost sheep. There's 100 sheep, and a man goes out because he loses one, goes, retrieves it, brings it back. And they celebrate. And it's followed up in verses 8 through 10, the parable of the lost coins. A woman who loses 10 coins, and then she finds them. And then they celebrate. You see this pattern that is coming through these stories, because these are all one after the other. These are all tied together. There is no break. Jesus says, here's this story, now this story, now this story. Three stories, and they all run through the same basic pattern. He says, who among you, when X happens, would not Y, and that will equal Z, which is celebration at the end, right? He says, who among you, when you lose this or lose that, would not do anything within your power to get that back? And then once it has been retrieved, that is, what was lost is now found, at that point, you're gonna celebrate. There's gonna be a party. It's the way with the sheep, it's the way with the lost coins. And then, in verse 11, again, there is no break, there is no stopping, there is nothing else. These are three parables that are set up. The first two are setting up the last one, because the last one's the one that really matters. And we're gonna see why that is in a little bit. But getting into our parable this morning, in verses 11 and 12, he said, there's a man who had two sons. Younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that's coming to me. And so he divided his property between them. Now notice that our numbers are going down. 100 sheep, 10 coins, two sons. And so this is all, you kind of feel this like narrowing in that's taking place. It's becoming more pointed with each story, and I think you're supposed to see that. And so this man comes to his father, the younger of the two, says, you know, Father, give me my share of the property. Now consider for just a second, what's he asking for when he says, give me my share of the property? He's saying, give me my inheritance, right? Give me my inheritance. Give me what would come to me if you were dead. I mean, that's basically what he's saying. He's saying, Father, I wish you were dead. You're not kicking the bucket fast enough, and I'm tired of waiting. I'm ready for this inheritance. I'm ready for you to be out of the way. That's what he's telling his father, is I wish you were dead so that I can get what's really important to me, which is not the relationship with the father. It is the money. It is the property. And so he says this to his father, and for the sake of the story, the father simply allows him. He allows him to take what's his, and he does. So after he takes what's his, verses 13 through 16, not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had, and he took a journey into a far country. There he squandered his property in reckless living. When he'd spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. You know, we call this the parable of the prodigal son often because of this section right here. And prodigals, sometimes I think, a misnomer to some degree, because usually we think prodigal means wayward, sinful, or something like that. Prodigal actually just simply means wasteful. This is the parable of the wasteful son, who had all of this inheritance, and then he was prodigal with it. He wasted it away. in overabundance. I mean, even in going out and having this abundance, he was very foolish with what he did, right? He didn't take care of it. He didn't try in any way, shape, or form to do what's right. He squandered it all. He was wasteful, overabundant. He was prodigal, and he lost it all. And of course, because this helps the story, after he loses everything, then a famine comes. Just to kind of dig it in just a little bit more. He has no sustenance. He has no hope at this point. He's got nothing that he can do except to go out and get a job. Consider for a moment, this man's never had to have a job before. In this way, being a hired hand. I'm sure he helped around the family farm and all of that, and he did work, don't get me wrong. But he's never been a hired individual. He's never been a servant before. He's always been the son. And that's the way that he's always been treated. And when he had everything, he continued living it up in that way. He wasn't wise with what he had. He'd always been really about himself. He's never had to hire himself out. And that's a problem now because no one's given him anything. There are no handouts. There's no plan in the background. There's no safety net. Well, I know my father's going to take care. There's nothing there. And so he gets a job. And understand, this is a story. Jesus is telling a story. This is a parable. And so the details matter. We're not reading, an historical account where it just so happens that, well, this happened. Jesus is very pointedly saying, this man went out and worked among the pigs. That's an important aspect. That's an important detail. He's among the pigs because the pigs signify a couple things. First of all, he's a long ways away, right? This is, once again, digging into the fact he went to a far country because they don't raise pigs there in Judea. They don't do it there in Galilee, in that area. You have to go somewhere else and go and leave your people completely if you're going to work for someone who's raising pigs. So that's the first thing to get across. But remember what pigs represent. They are unclean. They represent everything about being unholy. They represent being unholy among the Gentiles, right? I mean, that's the idea. It's those Gentiles out there. Those are the ones who raise the pigs. That's the ones with whom he is. In other words, this is a man who is doing the dirty work for Gentiles. And when I say doing the dirty work for the Gentiles, doing the jobs that the Gentiles are like, I'd rather not do that. And I'm going to leave that up to this guy who could be somewhere where things are great. Instead, he's chosen this life where by desperation or in desperation, he's doing the Gentiles' dirty work. Who does that kind of sound like in the first century? The people that hired on with Gentiles in order to do their dirty work among the people of Israel? Maybe the tax collectors? Maybe the sinners? Maybe the people who associated themselves out with the Romans, the Greeks in some kind of a way, the very ones that these people right here are saying, yeah, you have nothing to do with those people. They grumbled because Jesus was hanging out with the tax collectors and the sinners, right? That's exactly who this represents right here. Remember, this is the pertinent aspect of this parable. This is the one to whom he's gone. He is doing the dirty jobs for the pagans, for those Gentiles. He's far from home, he's far from his father, and he envies pigs for what they're eating. I've probably mentioned this before because I have a tendency to mention it a lot. Just it fits with the story at other places. But I grew up on a farm. We didn't have pigs, we had cows. But I would imagine that some of the feeding is kind of the same way. We had a slop bucket I don't know. Anybody here have a slop bucket that, you know, when you were growing up or anything like that? It was a 5-gallon bucket that you kept there in the kitchen, and scraps would go into it, rinds would go into it, all kinds of stuff. And it would get full, and then it would be my job was to take it. We had a road that came through our property, and the cows were on the other side. I'd have to take it across the road and dump the thing over the fence, and every time, it didn't matter how careful I was, it's, you know, splashing back on me, and it smelled bad, and it was gross. And not once did I ever look at that and think, oh man, that's some fine dining right there. I wonder if they'd like let me just have just a little bit of that, right? You know, that never happens. That doesn't happen unless you're in absolute, total, complete desperation. And here's this man. He is so desperate for any kind of sustenance that he is envious of what the pigs are eating, and he's not even allowed to have that. That's the kind of desperation that he finds himself in. Now, this leads then to this next section, starting verse 17. When he came to himself, he said, you know, how many of my father's hired hands have more than enough bread? But here I perish with hunger. I'm going to get up and go to my father, and I'm going to say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. When he came to himself, I think the New American Standard, when he came to his senses, or all translations will have something like that. When he realized just how horrible this situation was, which is what happens a lot of times when a person finally hits rock bottom, when they find themselves envious of what the pigs are eating, and they say, you know, this isn't right. My life was so much better than this at one point in time before I started making the decisions for myself. Things were a whole lot better off at one point. This is not the way it's supposed to be. He came to his senses and he said, why am I hiring myself out to these folks? I'm sure I could go and be a servant in my father's house because I know they're treated a whole lot better than I'm being treated. And he realizes at this point how much better his father is than what he had realized. You have to come to that realization when you hit rock bottom and you're able to compare everything else around you and you look at your circumstances and you look at how horrible things are and you say, you know, things are better with my father. That's the point that he gets to. That's the place that he gets to. And he says, I need to go back to my father. And he memorizes this little spiel. You see this, right? He said, all right. You know, I can see him walking along, practicing this. He's like, all right, here's what I'm going to say. Father, I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned before you. And I tell you what, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Please treat me as a hired servant. And he's reciting this, he's getting this, and he's making his way finally back to the father. And you get to verse 24, he arose and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion. And he ran, and he embraced him, and he kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quickly, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand. Put shoes on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. He does. He gets up. And he's coming to his father. And again, I can just see him kind of repeating this thing over and over. Getting ready. He's going to tell his father. And I think his father catches him by surprise because he's still far off. Which means his father was looking for him. Now, we're not talking a couple hours that's gone by, right? This is enough time for him to have squandered away an entire half of an inheritance. This is enough time for a famine to hit And enough time go by with the famine that it affects his ability to get any food. There's enough time for him to get a job and actually feed the pigs and do all of that. And enough time for him to finally come to his senses. There's been some time that's gone by. And in that entire time, the father has remained vigilant. Continuing to watch. Continuing to look. Hoping. Day in, day out, hoping. Is this the day? Is he going to return? There's an anticipation by the Father. There's a hope by the Father. And that hope becomes a reality. He sees this son returning. And this son, who by now, remember, he's been among the pigs, he's been in the muck, he's probably dirty, nasty, horrible, stinks. All kinds of things. You know, this is not the son who left, however long ago it was, who went out with an abundance of an inheritance. This is someone returning in a despicable fashion. And he comes out, and how does the father react? He runs to him. Now, again, I don't know how old these people are. We're just not given these details. But I'm 41, I think, still, something, I don't know. I'd have to do math. I think I'm 41. I can't run very much before I'm pretty winded. I'm just going to say that. I think this man's probably a little bit older than I am. You know, I kind of get the impression that these sons are not, you know, little children. And here he is, this older man, to some degree, is booking it. And he's running. Now, he also seems to be, if he is respected and this type of a person, he's probably someone who's got a lot of respect within the community. And something you don't see respectful people do very often is what? Run. They just don't. It's one of those things. Life can wait. I'm important enough that life can wait for me. And maybe it's also a thing of maturation that you realize life can wait a little bit. I don't have to run here, run here, run here. But this man runs. And he runs, not caring what anybody else, whoever else, whatever the case, whatever they say. He runs and he grabs him and he embraces him and all of his filth and stench and stink and dirt and everything else, embraces him and kisses him. And you can see the son kind of wiggling out because he knows that he's not worthy of this. And he says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But what doesn't he say? He doesn't say, make me as one of your servants. And some people might say, in fact, I've heard some people say that he kind of got a little cold feet at that point. I don't think that's really the case. I think it's at that moment that the father simply interrupts him. He's not able to say it because the father is like, shut up, you are one of my sons. Come on, we're going to party. and he says, look at you. What kind of a state are you? My son is not supposed to be in this state. And he clothes his son. Look at the things that he gives him. The best robe, a ring, shoes on his feet. And they get the fattened calf and they kill it and they celebrate. You know, he tries to come up here and say, you know what, Father, just make me a hired hand. And the Father doesn't even let him get there because he says, you are my son. Now, here's a question. What should have happened to this guy, this wasteful guy who went out? He basically told his father, I wish you were dead. I can't wait for you to die. So I'm just going to take my stuff and go and squander in worthless living. What should have happened to this guy? Well, we talked about a law from the law of Moses just over a month ago, didn't we? In Deuteronomy chapter 21. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and even though they discipline him, will not listen to them, his father and his mother shall take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives, and say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn, rebellious, he will not obey our voice, he is a glutton and a drunkard, and all the men of the city will stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. You know, and maybe the scene doesn't exactly fit this, but consider for just a moment. I mean, this law's here on the books. Maybe this is what should have been done with the son as he was trying to go away. But even so, as he's returning, shouldn't he have to do something? Shouldn't the father at least say, hey, I want you to acknowledge, first of all, the pain that you put me through. I want you to acknowledge how much shame went upon me because you went and did what you did. And everybody was talking about it. It's been the talk of the town since you've been gone. I want you to go at least to the elders of the city, stand before everybody, and make a public confession of your guilt and say, I'm wrong, I've sinned, and I need forgiveness from everybody here. He should go through some kind of hoops, shouldn't he? Shouldn't there be something here that the father says, you know what, if you want to be back in good graces with me, you got to earn this, buddy. You got to do this, this, or this, so that you can show that you've changed. You have to prove to me, before anything else, that you indeed are genuine and honest, and that you've changed. What's the father require? Any of that? Doesn't even let him finish his speech. And he stops him and he says, no, we're going to celebrate. You ever thought about that? Why is that? Well, it's because the relationship to the Father is not based on some kind of meritorious scale. The relationship with the Father does not have to be earned in any way, shape, or form. He is the Father's Son. He has always been the Father's Son. He always will be the Father's Son. And that relationship is always there, whether this person earns it or not. He is the Son. And then the Father provides a great feast for this Son. And you see, again, everything that happens right here, you know, and then they, let me come back to it. they get the fattened calf, and they eat, and they celebrate, and all these things have happened. Why? Because what was lost is now found. Remember, this is where it all started, right? The 100 sheep, and then the one, what was lost is now found. We celebrate. The 10 coins, right? They found the coins, what was lost is now found. Now the parable of the lost son, what was lost is now found. He was dead, now he's alive. What was lost is now found. And I tell you what, if we end right there, that's powerful enough, isn't it? That's really cool. That is great, but it doesn't end there because Jesus has got just a little bit more to say. Starting in verse 25, the older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked, what do these things mean? And he said to him, your brother has come. Your father killed the fattened calf because he received him back safe and sound. But his brother was angry. He refused to go in. His father came out and treated him, but he answered his father, look, these many years I've served you. I've never disobeyed your command. You've never given me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him. I think he's a little angry here, isn't he? Just a little upset. Why? Where's he coming from? He's coming from the field. He's coming from doing the work that younger brother's supposed to be doing. They're both supposed to be out there in the field. And yet this younger brother was out gallivanting, doing this, doing that, doing whatever. And this older brother's coming from the field and he finds there's a celebration for one of the sons of the father. And it's not whom? It's not the one coming from the field. He's celebrating the one who went out and just wasted everything and all kinds of sinfulness. And he's like, how is that fair? Here I am slaving away, doing what I'm supposed to, being obedient. I never get these things. This is not fair. He's got a point, doesn't he? I mean, isn't that a fair assessment? He refuses to go in because this father is not acting the way the father's supposed to act. That's the problem. So what does the father do? Don't mistake this. Don't overlook this. The father does the exact same thing that he did for that first son. He came to him. In both cases, the father goes to meet his son. When he sees him there, he goes to meet him. And he has a good point here. So what's wrong with this reaction? I mean, this is fair. This is right. How many of you would feel good if you have slaved away all day, you're walking in from the field, and you find out that they're celebrating your little brother, and they're saying, hey, what a great job he's done over the last few years. Right? I mean, if you're going to be honest, that's going to burn you just a little bit. This isn't fair. So what's the difference between this brother and the father? You know, I think the brother reveals here the thoughts that he's had for his brother. I think it's envy. It's what it's tied to. I mean, going all the way back to the very first brother relationship there was, right? It's envy that's taking place here. And please note, the narrator does not ever tell us what the younger son squandered his money on, right? He doesn't mention anything about prostitutes, the narrator, earlier. I really think this is coming from the imagination of the older son, who has obviously been thinking about what his little brother's been doing. And here he is slaving away in the field, doing this, doing that, doing all of this, while what's happening? Yeah, his little brother's getting to live it up out there, doing who knows what, all kinds of crazy things. He's probably out there with the prostitutes and everything else. I think he's been thinking a lot about what that brother's been doing. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. It's not envy in that he necessarily wishes he was the one who had been going out and squandering money on prostitutes. Don't read that into what I'm saying. I think the envy is that his brother gets away with sin with complete impunity. In fact, it seems as if the sinfulness of his brother is actually being celebrated. Here he is slaving away doing what's right. And then his brother goes out and sins, and they celebrate his sinfulness. And so he throws up his hands. He says, why am I even bothering to be the dutiful son? You know, this is a lot like Asaph in Psalm 73. Here in this psalm, we're just going to look at a few of the places here. But Asaph in Psalm 73, as he's looking out at the wicked, he says, as for me, my feet almost stumbled. My steps nearly slipped because I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. And then he says, all in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. And I happen to think maybe that's a question. He says, have I done this all in vain? Have I kept my hands clean? Have I done what's right, been obedient and dutiful? When the wicked get to do whatever they want to without any kind of punishment? Well, that's the way I think that this brother is looking at his younger brother. He never got as far as Asaph did. He never saw what I think the father in the parable sees. You move on to verses 16 and 17. Asaph goes on to say, when I thought how to understand this, it seemed a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I perceived therein. In other words, I looked at them and I thought, man, here I am slaving away, being obedient, and they're living it up with impunity. You know, that, he's like, why am I even doing it? I'm just going to throw my hands up and forget about it. Until, he says, I looked at it from God's perspective and I realized what their end was going to be. Yeah, they may have some kind of fun life in some way, shape, or form, but the real end is going to be horrible for them. It's only going to lead to true death. And when you start to see it that way, you become a lot less envious. You see, here's the problem. The brother never actually saw his younger brother as dead. He never saw the younger brother as lost. He saw him the entire time as quite alive and living it up. Nothing refraining him from doing what he wanted to do. He never had the father's perspective because the father didn't look at him as just somebody living it up. The father looked at him and said, that's a lifestyle that ends in death. And unless something changes, that is death. He is lost. That's why the older brother has a problem. He never views the younger son in that way. He doesn't actually see him in a lost condition. So there is no joy when he returns. What is the father's plea? In verse 31, the father said to him, you know what, son, you're always with me. All that is mine is yours. But it is fitting, it is important, it is necessary for us to celebrate right now and be glad because this brother was dead and he's alive. He was lost and now he's found. I think it's important that we note here, the father still loves the older son, right? The relationship with the older son has not changed just because at the moment the father's focused on and maybe making a bigger deal about how much his younger son mattered to him. That does not mean the relationship that he has with the older brother no longer matters. You know, keep in mind, both of these sons are important to this father, but he says right now in this moment, the focus needs to be on this younger son. He's the one who was lost and is now found. The relationship of the son to the father, that is the son to that old, the older son to the father again, it is not based on some meritorious scale. He does not have more worth because he's been dutiful. He does not have more worth because he's been obedient. He is not more worthy because he's coming from the field instead of coming from some place over there doing who knows what. He is a son in the exact same way. He still has the robe. He has the ring. He has the shoes. And at the end, who seems to be the true lost son of this parable? Is it the one who went out and squandered everything? What do you think the reaction would have been if this son, who was standing out at a distance and refused to go in and celebrate his brother's return, what do you think would have been the reaction of the father if he would have decided to come on in and join? I guarantee you it would have ended in more celebration. That would have been the end result. Because as it stands right now, this older brother has become the lost son who can't get back a relationship with his brother. I would think if the story were concluded by Jesus in that way, he would say what was lost is now found again. Which is why I think it's a good idea for us right now today to look at this very loving father, an example of what a loving father is, and to demonstrate how a father's relationship to his children are. A loving father is first and foremost merciful. Now, I'm going to use definitions that aren't necessarily always used regarding mercy and grace. The technical definitions that get muddled in common usage. But technically speaking, mercy is when you don't give someone a negative action that they deserve. Yeah, that's basically how I would define that. This brother who returned, he should have been rung through the ringer. He should have had all kinds of bad things happen to him. He should have had to have proven his worth. But again, he doesn't have to, because a loving father is merciful to his children. And as parents, yes, discipline is important. And it's important that we understand that. We know that that is the case. But mercy is just as important. And there's a lot of wisdom that goes into knowing when is this a moment where discipline is going to be the right action, or when is this a moment in which mercy is actually going to have more impact on this child moving forward than discipline would. A loving father understands the place and the importance of mercy. A loving father also understands grace. Grace here I would define as providing for someone something positive which they don't deserve. And that's exactly what the prodigal son here, the wasteful son, as he returns, having been prodigal and wasting everything, coming back in horrible, smelly clothing, everything else, he's granted more than just a servant status. He's given the robe. He's given the shoes. He's given the ring. And you could almost say that the father goes over the top in response to the son. You can almost say that the father is just as prodigal as the son was on the one side. It's almost as if the father on the other side is prodigal. Remember, prodigal is not a negative term. It just simply means over the top, is kind of the idea. He goes over the top in the celebration that you find. A father knows when the times are to not only show mercy, but when it's a good time and when it's a proper time to go over the top in demonstrating the love that you have for your children so that they are never, ever in doubt. And that doesn't mean over the top with money, things, consumer items or whatever. There's all kinds of ways to be over the top in demonstrating love. And a father recognizes that. And let me suggest to you, a loving father comes to meet his children. In both instances, the father had to come to them. He sees the one from far off, and the one who's coming back in sin, who is ashamed, the one who knows that he is hurt, the one that is scared of what the father's going to say, the father runs to him, embraces him, and kisses him before the son even has a chance to say the first word. He runs to meet him. And even those on the other side, he came out to his son. You know, a father doesn't just sit around and wait. I mean, there is some of that in this story, right? But a father goes to meet his children, come to them and say, what's the issue? What's happening? We need to work this out. That's what a loving father does. And I hope that as we talked about these things, I don't have to really spend too much time saying that's what our loving father does. I mean, this whole story, yes, is a good story about how a father deals with his children. This story is a story about how God deals with his children and how God deals with his people. That's the picture that we're supposed to see. And it's those tax collectors, those sinners, and those others, as they are coming to Jesus. Jesus is looking at the scribes and Pharisees who are saying, are you serious? Are you hanging out with them? And he's saying, how do you think God's going to react to these people? When they come back to the Father, how do you think God's going to treat them? I guarantee you, this is how He's going to treat them. This is what's going to happen. Which is why you look at the end and you say, did that other son ever go into the party? We don't know. This story is left wide open. And it is so for a reason. because this is to those people who grumble, those scribes and Pharisees who grumbled that Jesus ate with the wrong sort, those lost sons. When in reality, it's those Pharisees who are the true lost sons. And as Jesus is teaching this parable, he's inviting the scribes, he's inviting the Pharisees, he's saying, I want you to recognize who you are in this story. And I'm not going to finish the story. He says, I want you to finish the story. He tells the scribes and Pharisees, I want you to be the ones who by your actions demonstrate that you are that son and you are going to change how you're treating those tax collectors and those sinners. Of course, we know they won't do that. It's not going to happen. But that's how this story ends. And as we read it again, it doesn't matter what that lost son did or didn't do. It's what the scribes, it's really not what the scribes and Pharisees did, because this is one of those timeless stories that as for us as the reader, the question is, what will we do? We are called to recognize where we are in the story. And more often than not, if you are an individual who is studying this story in this kind of a setting, where you are coming and you're reading it and you're worshiping and such, you're not here because you're that wayward prodigal son who's just returning from doing who knows what. More likely, you're in that other son position. And the story is just as much for me, for you, for all of us to say, how are we going to react? May God give us the wisdom to see who we are. And find a way to make sure that we are eternally there in that great celebration that will happen. Let's pray together. Our mighty God, we know that you indeed are merciful, that you are gracious, and we are just, there are no words to describe how thankful we are that you came to us, that you sent your Son, that you brought God in the flesh, to be here, to go through what Jesus did. Help us to always appreciate that sacrifice, to demonstrate the love that you've shown to us, to others. Help us to live to the praise of your glory. We thank you for the hope that we have of that great celebration. Help us to make sure that we are there, no matter what. We thank you for Jesus, for the hope that we have that comes through his resurrection. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. In just a moment, we